In the hours after we recorded this episode on Friday, the board of Aussie Media issued a statement saying that the organization would be shutting down.
Hello! Welcome to the contrarian episode of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios. I'm here with Emily Peck of Fundrise.
Hello.
I'm here with Stacey Marie Ishmael of Bloomberg.
Hello.
And we have a very special guest. We have Max Chafkin, also of Bloomberg. Welcome, Max.
Hey.
Max is an editor at Bloomberg who edited a great story about corporate insider trading. So obviously we're going to talk about that. We are also all full-time employees of media organizations. And so obviously we're going to talk about the implosion of Aussie. Maybe we're not. Maybe
we are not.
Emily works for a fintech and so she's not a media person anymore.
Correct.
But she's still a media person in her heart. I can see behind her eyes. She's like, yeah, I'm a media person. So we're going to talk about Aussie media, which imploded this week. But mostly, and most importantly, we're going to talk about Max's book. Max, you have written a book. What is it?
It's called The Contrarian, and it's a biography of Peter Thiel, the tech investor and Republican kind of political figure. And it also sort of doubles as a study in Silicon Valley power.
Available at all good local bookstores right now. Go out and buy it. All of that coming up on Slate Money.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So, Max, you have written a biography of Peter Thiel. He is this multi-gazillionaire who really represents a certain strain of sort of crazy libertarian thinking in Silicon Valley. Is that the reason why you wrote the book, that you think he's like emblematic of something, of a bigger thing, or is he kind of unique?
Well, I agree that he's emblematic of the kind of crazy libertarian thing. But the reason I wrote the book is because I think he's emblematic of something else, which is this, you know, this kind of veneration of a certain kind of tech company and a certain kind of quote-unquote disruption. So this idea that tech companies should get as big as possible, as quickly as possible, pushing towards, you know, basically monopoly dominance of their markets while, you know, if at all possible, breaking as many rules as possible. So, and I think that, you know, is kind of like, you could think about that as the sort of cult of disruption or kind of the Facebook business model or something like that. You know, Thiel was, of course, an early advisor to Mark Zuckerberg, the first outside investor, longest serving board member. He's had a huge impact on kind of the development of that company. And I would argue his kind of thinking, and I mean this outside of the political context, although, you know, we can talk about that too, because I think it's interesting. His kind of basic playbook is sort of at play at every tech company. And it helps explain a lot of both why these tech companies are so powerful and also kind of where they're going wrong.
Yeah, it was really interesting to me to think about reading your book, the connection between Thiel's politics, which are, I don't know if they're actually libertarian, but they're certainly anti-democratic, and he tends to like dictators, monopolies, etc., and the way he ran PayPal, and then how that anti-democratic politics trickles down into the tech world, into Silicon Valley. Yet Silicon Valley somehow comes off looking really good for a really long time. Like, the politics is embedding this philosophy of like move fast, disrupt, break things. And you should tell listeners maybe about how PayPal kind of embodied that. And yet they're still looked at as like great actors in our democracy, like innovators and bringing us the new way and the future. But really underneath it all is this very creepy bent towards dictatorship and really anti-democratic sentiment. So yeah, maybe tell us about the PayPal thing.
Absolutely agree. I mean, I think people describe him as a libertarian, and of course he does have some libertarian inclinations, like the inclination to not pay taxes or the inclination that, you know, tech billionaires should be allowed to get away with whatever they want to get away with. But I think, as you say, his politics are probably more complicated, more authoritarian than what we normally think of as a libertarian perspective. And so with PayPal, you know, everyone in tech kind of knows, or many people in tech know about the PayPal mafia. That's this crew of sort of executive, basically friends of Peter Thiel, who've gone around, you know, investing in each other's companies and sort of moving money around, and they've created this really powerful influence network. But the thing is, there's also this ideological network and their ideological underpinnings of the PayPal mafia. We think of PayPal as this kind of, oh, it's a nice way to basically buy things on eBay or send your friends money to split the check or something. But of course, Thiel saw it in 1999, 2000 as this, you know, libertarian project, as a way to take basically power or sovereignty away from countries. He talked about giving everyone a Swiss bank account in their pocket. And the idea being that, you know, once you have this kind of digital wallet, it's going to be very hard for any country. Back then, he's talking mostly about kind of repressive countries, not necessarily the United States, but it's going to be very hard for countries to kind of control that. And I think like that is, so I think like that kind of ethos is embedded in the way all of these companies think, no matter what their politics are. Maybe they may donate to Democrats or something, but I still think they kind of agree with this basic idea. And of course, it's totally embedded in crypto. I mean, it's like exactly how, or not all of them, but a lot of crypto people sort of see the world and see the advantages of that technology.
So tell me a little bit about the PayPal mafia. This is something that I've always been curious about. You see Peter Thiel as the sort of center of that, of those concentric circles. But to what extent, if I'm looking at Reid Hoffman or Elon Musk or Max Levchin of Affirm, like, to what degree can I kind of understand them through that lens? Like, are they presumptively similar to Thiel?
Well, I think the answer is yes and no. So Musk is kind of a special case. You know, Musk is, he's kind of lumped in with the PayPal mafia, but you know, Thiel cooed him in like 2001 while Musk was the CEO. Thiel, you know, engineered this coup that bounced Musk out of the company, and they've had kind of a difficult friendship or frenemyship basically ever since. I think
Max, say the quote that someone told you that.
Yeah,
Musk,
yeah. There's a Peter quote in the Musk book that says, Peter thinks that Elon is a fraud and a braggart, and Elon thinks that Peter is a sociopath. And I think they obviously have shared interests, and I think they're definitely aligned in certain areas, but they're very different people, and there's definitely still a little bit of bad blood over this PayPal coup, which has been leavened over the years by Peter has made investments in Elon's company, so it's not totally clean in any direction.
So, let me just stop you very quickly,
yeah,
because I need to ask you this. Does Peter think that Peter is a sociopath? Like, I kind of think he does.
He would love you to think that, I'm sure.
I don't think he does think that he's a sociopath. And I'm not sure that I do.
What I want to know is, what does he think of himself as? Like, what is in your reporting for this book and your interviews with folks who are close to him, you know, the picture is varied and variable. And what do you think is the image that he thinks he's projecting into the world?
I think he sees himself as a kind of like Ayn Randian superhero, like some kind of combination of Ayn Rand and like one of her characters, basically like a public intellectual. And I think he's very invested, and you can see this in kind of like who he talks to, the way he talks. You know, he's very invested in this idea of himself as like a philosopher. And he's, you know, published, self-published at times, you know, books, and he's definitely like invested in that part of him, of his own, you know, perspective. And I think, you know, to varying degrees of success. Like, I think there are aspects of his book Zero to One that I think are really interesting and provocative. And at times he's been provocative and really interesting. I think he has also, though, and this kind of maybe gets to what Felix is saying, he's kind of played the heel at times, you know? Like, I think he's somebody who
likes... This is a wrestling reference for folks who are listening.
Yes.
Heel is the bad guy in the wrestling match.
but also playing the heel is something that is very connected to my favorite word in the English language, which is kayfabe, which is basically you don't believe really in what you're doing. It's all for show. And I don't think it's for show, right? He actually, like, he enjoys being the villain, but he enjoys being the villain rather than just pretending to be the villain.
I think maybe. Fun fact, Peter Thiel is a wrestling fan. He talks about kayfabe all the time. So, like, I don't think it's totally far-fetched. I mean, of course, he backed Hulk Hogan in that lawsuit. So he's had at least some... I think he's gone as Hulk Hogan to at least one costume party as well. I'd have to double-check that, but I think. Anyway, what I was going to say is... Maybe, but he definitely has used it to his advantage. And the place where I think that's most clear is Palantir. So you would think a company that's like a surveillance thing that has a lot of government contracts, that's been criticized by privacy advocates for, you know, doing too much data mining, would sort of go out of its way to avoid being compared to Big Brother. But Palantir kind of embraced those comparisons and continues to this day to embrace comparisons. There was an Axios interview, you know, with Alex Karp right before they went public where he was talking about, you know, the amazing power that we have. We have to make sure we don't abuse it. And I think the reason that they've embraced that is because it sells, basically. Like, when you're seen as powerful, it gives you additional power. And I think Thiel has been really good at kind of projecting that in kind of both directions, in courting, in projecting power on the right, but also kind of getting the left spun up. And that's a thing he's done his entire career, you know, even before he was in tech, is be super good at kind of creating these provocations. You know, people talk about... and we're talking about the PayPal mafia, but I sometimes think it'd be more helpful to call it the Stanford Review mafia, because many of those folks actually came out of Thiel's, you know, right-wing kind of trolley newspaper at Stanford. That doesn't include Elon Musk, Reid Hoffman, or Max Levchin, the three that Felix brought up, but it does include, you know, a bunch of these other folks. And I think that kind of right-wing kind of conservative activist energy was part of the kind of cultural coherence of PayPal and gives meaning and coherence to this group going forward.
Some of the things you were just talking about, Max, point to Peter Thiel's success. His true talent, I think, just lies in marketing. He markets himself as resident bad guy. He's good at projecting an image of himself. And like this book, though, very revealing about him, I bet he's probably happy with, because it portrays him kind of like this like smart, kind of brilliant contrarian who's had all this success. But if you like dial it back, like even PayPal, that was Max Levchin's success. Peter Thiel was the marketer. He was the one, you know, pushing for things like pay people to sign up for PayPal to get the monopoly. Like that's his genius. The genius is, like with so many of these tech people, the genius is in the marketing. It's in the acquisition of customers. It's not in the innovating. He wants to go out, that Peter Thiel go out and talk about innovation and how Silicon Valley doesn't invent really good science or tech stuff anymore, and then like pay people to drop out of college. But it's all marketing, like you lay out in the book so well, the Thiel Fellowship, where he's paying these little kids to drop out of school and like pushing them to become entrepreneurs at the age of 17. Like that's truly insane. It's all marketing.
Yeah, that in particular was a PR stunt. And I think that is one, I mean, that one to me is very clear cut. Like they really had not thought through really any aspect of it except for like the announcement and what that was going to be like. And when you're talking about children, I mean, of course, these are teenage children. They're not, you know, they're not little kids, but still like, you know, it's I really think it's pretty questionable. And I completely agree with your assessment about Thiel as a marketer. And I think that's something that, this kind of goes beyond Thiel. I think a lot of these kind of brilliant tech people, they're not necessarily amazing technologists or anything like that. They're really good marketers. It is in some ways a marketing story.
Is there a kind of tension though between Peter Thiel's sort of stated love of monopolies, and he's very, very explicit about saying that everyone should be a monopoly. It's the only way you can make money, and he said that literally in as many words. And so, like, he goes out and he markets something like Palantir as being, we have a set of panopticon, a technological panopticon, which is unrivaled by anyone else on the planet, and we have a monopoly on this incredible technology, and if you want to exercise your power globally and you're the CIA or something like that, you basically need to use us. And the CIA looks at this and gets stars in their eyes and throws lots of money at him and all the rest of it. And it works as a marketing campaign, and it definitely works if you're trying to sell technology to you know, intelligence agencies around the world. This is the kind of thing they love to hear and they love to buy. But that still raises the question of whether it's true or not. And like, you know, reading your book and sort of between the lines of the whole Palantir story, it kind of sounds like Palantir really wasn't a monopoly on, didn't have a monopoly on anything. Their technology was kind of fair to middling. And it really is just a marketing story. And I feel there's a tension there that, like, he is out there sort of saying, build a monopoly. And everyone's like, well, that's what you're doing. That's what, you know. That the reason they believe his marketing is because of the book, and the book is really just a form of marketing.
You mean Thiel's book or the book where he said,
zero to one.
Yeah,
it's like, it's like don't make incremental steps, just like revolutionize everything. And they're like, oh, well, in that case, Palantir is, you know, you have a multi-billion-dollar stake in Palantir. That must be a monopoly too.
Well, yeah. And I think, so there's been this kind of tension in the press coverage of Palantir that we've seen play out again and again over the years, where you have sort of two lines of criticism. One is Palantir is a panopticon and is, you know, taking our privacy and everything like that. And the other is this business is not very good. And you saw there were all these BuzzFeed stories written in like 2015, 2016 that were kind of dismissed and mostly ignored by the press about how they were getting dropped by all these big American companies, Coca-Cola, and I think J.P. Morgan, or maybe it's Pepsi. Anyway, a bunch of like major, you know, largest companies in the world dropped them around that time. And it was because the software wasn't working very well. And I think a couple things going on. One is that when you're a government contractor, you can maybe get away with having not great software. I mean, like, I think it's possible that Palantir software like doesn't work that well, and yet maybe it's better than the like Raytheon software. Like, I don't think like the companies that cater to this market are necessarily as rigorous or whatever. Like, you know, they're probably not as good at software as, you know, Amazon, Microsoft, or whoever. So I think it's possible they could be better. I also think even if you sort of like accept the fact that Palantir has failings, there's still things that they've done that cause me to worry. And that part of that comes from the fact that there's reporting, and there's also reporting of the in the book, new reporting about ways in which they've sort of ignored their ethical responsibilities to sort of safeguard data to make sure their product isn't used poorly. But it's also bad because this marketing that you're talking about creates a new permission structure, right? It creates incentives for other people to go out and try the same thing. And I think that is something that's what's dangerous about what a lot of the stuff that Thiel has done or been involved with, where it's not even necessarily what he's doing. It's like he's creating this really bad example that then has a big impact in the world. Zero to one, you know, like you said, it argues that monopoly is good. It's the end point of business, which is not, to my mind, that's a pretty radical break from like capitalism as I understand it. And it was marketed as a self-help book. It's like monopoly is great and you can too. And I think that's a little bit troubling, and especially troubling when you're talking about the people who are listening to him. And these are the people who, I'm going to spout some marketing here, but it does have truth to it. I mean, these are the people who are building the future, and they've bought into a lot of these ideas that I think are much further away from kind of like our sort of shared value system than most of us realize.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office.
More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, so Max, this is a good segue into insider trading, which you didn't write this article in Business Week about corporate insider trading, but you did edit it and you said lots of nice words about it on Twitter. So we can ask you all of our questions about corporate insider trading and whether it's bad and why it's bad. But can you just give us briefly the sort of thesis of the article?
Yeah. So the article talks about a new sort of strain of research that's being done primarily at Wharton, but there are other sort of basically business school professors who are looking into this, and they're doing quantitative analysis of insiders' trades. And insiders are basically executives, like C-level executives, directors, people own more than 10% of the stock. And every time they trade, right, they have to file this form. It's called a Form 4. And you can look at these Form 4s, right? You can see all their trades. You can do statistical analysis to ask, you know, how lucky were they when they make money? And what they're finding is that they're very, very, very lucky, right? Like these are, like they're winning at rates that are improbable. It's like as the writer of the piece.
Well, when you're saying they, do you mean like executives in general, like 100% of them in aggregate, or do you mean specific ones here and there?
Both, right? I mean, there are specific ones here and there that are winning at absurd rates. Probably, I guess when the analogy I was about to do, which is like, it's like making the final table at the World Series of Poker, you know, multiple times in a row, right? Which is like possible, but it's not common. And when you look at the aggregate, they're outperforming, you know, the market by a lot. So that's the research, right? And it's interesting. And what the article argues is basically that there's an open secret on Wall Street, and not just on Wall Street, that nobody cares. That basically within these companies, and actually what I found most provocative about in the story is it's not just within the companies, it's within the regulators, right? They just have decided that basically, and I'm speaking broadly, you know, one of the perks of being an executive at a company is to be able to trade on inside information. And so you just have like example after example of this happening, and a reluctance, I guess, on the part of anyone to do anything about it. And I think it's interesting, and it raises questions about, it raises important questions, I'd say, about whether, first of all, whether or not anything could be done about it without like drastically reshaping our, you know, whatever, like how we structure companies and what we allow of executives, and also just kind of broad questions about fairness of the market.
I'm going to try and carve out the other side of this one.
It's, I figured.
Because number one, this is about as close as it is possible to humanly come to a victimless crime. That, like, really no one is hurt. And you make the argument, or rather you cite the argument without making the argument in the article, that it can actually be beneficial in terms of making markets more efficient. And I'm not going to necessarily go that far, although, yeah, I mean, the whole point about markets is that there are a price discovery mechanism where you get thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of people all trading in and out of a whole bunch of different securities at the same time. And then the emergent property from that is basically like, where does the market think that something should trade? And at the margin, yeah, the people who know the companies best, which is that the executives of those companies, certainly do have a better sense of where that company is going, and they're more likely to sort of buy when it's going about to go up and sell when it's about to go down. And so, you know, they help push the prices in the sort of correct direction. I don't think that's particularly positive. I don't think that's necessarily a wonderful thing. But I don't, by the same token, think that there's an obvious victim there.
So on that point, I'm looking at that story, and I'm also looking at the Wall Street Journal story that they also published this week about all of the federal judges who were hearing cases in which they had a financial interest. And one of the judges' arguments, which I think is slightly more plausible than the exact arguments, is that they just straight up like didn't know, right? They weren't paying attention. They weren't, I'm too rich to care about about what's in my investment portfolio. And, you know, there again, Felix, to your idea of this being kind of a victimless crime, I have always kind of struggled with the, like, I don't think that people are immune to financial responding to financial incentives. I also don't think that people necessarily are always super aware of those financial incentives when they're making decisions.
And this reminds me a lot of the of like journalistic ethics discussions about how you can't own stock in the companies that you're writing about. And sure, like that would be a conflict. There's no doubt that if you own stock in a company you're writing about, that would be a conflict. On the other hand, if you're writing about a company, you are taking executives of that company out for drinks on a regular basis and trying to like pump them for information and learn about what's going on inside that company. And you're building up these very human relationships with these people who you're spending hours and hours with over drinks. And the idea that like having a intense human relationships with executives of a company is not a conflict, whereas like owning $500 worth of stock in the company is a conflict. You know, it seems weird to me.
What about the scenarios? Like, okay, yeah, you're a C-suite exec, you know your company's doing well and you leverage that information for your benefit. Fine. But what about like the examples in the story Max edited where it's like one Boeing executive, you know, sold $5 million of stocks knowing that, you know, the company was responsible for a plane crash that killed people ahead of that news coming out, or at Under Armour, they're selling stock right before they make an announcement acknowledging like fraud or whatever. That stuff seems so icky. I don't want executives, you know, trading stock ahead of like bad news about fraud or death. Like that just seems wrong to me. Like, you know, something that could really change the way everyone sees your company. You're profiting off of this like bad news. I don't know how you police that versus the other kind of insider trading, but it seems icky.
Can I push back on the victimless thing, building on what Emily said? I mean, I don't know why you're saying it's victimless, because like if you found out today like that some executive is just going down Fifth Avenue and just sort of stealing randomly from people, $20 here, $20 there, and it adds up to millions of dollars, that would be, I think that is not a victimless crime. Yes, like he hasn't like impoverished any, you know, elderly people or whatever. He hasn't cost like the Wilpons all their money, like, you know, Bernie Madoff or something. But that's not good. And that's kind of what's happening in some of these cases, right? It's all like, right.
Max, explain to me who are the people losing $20 here and $20 there?
Well, you don't feel a little bummed out by, say, a pharmaceutical company that if you're an investor in an index fund and your index fund sells at the prevailing market price because it's rebalancing or something to a pharmaceutical executive who knows the stock's about to go up by $3 a share or something, you don't think that like that doesn't like bum you out just a little bit, that like that this executive took $3 of profits like out of your pocket per share?
But they didn't. But that's the whole point. The index fund had to rebalance. It had to enter the market and sell. That
yeah, but
was
it didn't
the market
have to sell
price.
At that yeah, but the market was. It was
yeah, but so if there was an extra buyer out there buying the stock, that actually raises the price that the index fund gets for the selling that it was doing anyway. It didn't know that there was news about to come out, and so it would have sold whether or not that executive was in the market. It would have sold at that price whether or not the executive was in the market. Arguably, it would have sold at a slightly lower price if the executive wasn't in the market. So I don't see how that fund lost any money at all.
I was going to say, I think the problem is when the executives know bad news that's going to force the stock price to go down and they profit and the people in the index fund don't. And then the people in the index fund lose money once the news comes out.
But my point is that I agree that ethically this is odious. Where I disagree is that there are victims, because absent that insider trading, the stock would still have gone down and the people in the index fund would still have lost money. That there is no difference in outcome for the index funds or for anyone else. There is no victim here.
But of course, the executive can make a different decision, right? Instead of calling their broker and saying, like, buy a bunch of shares or sell a bunch of shares, they could do the more transparent thing and announce the news, right? And tell everyone what had happened. And instead, they are acting in their own personal financial interests, it appears.
I think what we're describing is kind of a spectrum. And again, going back to the, I knew a thing, and because I knew that thing, I am deliberately taking an action, to I'm blithely unaware of what I'm even holding, and I'm, you know, ruling on, arbitrating on, making decisions about things that will in fact be affected by my decision, but that's not necessarily like something that's even at the forefront or back of my mind when I'm doing so. And so I think that, you know, I do think intentionality here and awareness are, they don't make it more or less ethical, but they do increase the probability that you are knowingly doing something that could hurt or affect somebody else.
I have a question for Max, which is 50% about insider trading and 50% about how to read financial journalism, which is one of the things which I like to think about a lot. And I've been writing about for, you know, 15 years. Every so often when I read one of these stories, I will come across a passage a bit like this. So in your story, you talk about the CEO of Greenwich Life Sciences, who had high returns on the purchases he made of stock, because four of the trades preceded the announcement of promising results from a cancer drugs trial. And you're like, okay, that makes sense. And then in the next sentence, you say, Patel points out that the success of the Greenwich Life Sciences trial was referenced on the company's website and IPO prospectus before he traded. So now I'm like, we have two sentences next to each other. One of them saying he traded before this was announced, and then the next sentence was like, he points out that it was actually announced. How am I supposed to read that? What, like, it seems like you're sort of contradicting yourself there.
No, it's, I mean, the idea is the information was kind of buried or something, you know? I mean, I think that's the implication, that although a very careful reader would have seen it, although a less careful reader would not have. And I think that's, again, you can debate whether that's satisfactory or not. But we haven't talked about these trading plans, which I think are another somewhat scandalous thing, where the companies sort of claim that these are planned transactions, but then when you actually dig into it, like, a trading plan is just like, I'm going to make a trade today, and you can trade it, and you can change it at any time. And anytime they're accused of impropriety, they just, you know, fall back on these rules. And so I don't know. I mean, I think it's like a case of where the thing that's acceptable, like legal, is more scandalous than the illegal behavior. Like, no one's saying these guys are breaking, you know, any, you know, it's not even clear that they're breaking any rules. It feels ethically dubious, and it feels like it may be worth revisiting some of the structure, including these trading plans, which I think is the thing that, like, you know, the government is most focused on in this story.
So yeah, and we've definitely had Gary Gensler talk about this in Congress. I think that you're absolutely right that there is a bunch of freedom that people have, that the trading plans are supposed to constrain, but in fact they don't really constrain it at all. Obviously, you know, the way that American capitalism works is that executives get given stock. There's no point in giving executive stock unless they can actually sell it at some point somehow. There needs to be some way for them to sell stock, you know, otherwise they're just not going to value it. But there are some, I guess, proposals out there that would firm up the rules about how far in advance you need to telegraph these, you know, such sales or purchases and that kind of thing. Is that basically the takeaway from the article? Is that, like, for sort of moral reasons, we want to sort of tighten up on those rules a bit?
That's my takeaway. I mean, you didn't even make the most fun counterargument, which is that insider information is intellectual property, and therefore, you know, like, that's the more extreme sort of libertarian argument for insider trading, not the efficiency thing, but that companies should be able to, you know, do whatever they want with their information, including, you know, make money in the market, which I find really, you know, kind of fun and also provocative. For me,
oh, I mean, like, know, so like there was, yeah, there was a very interesting and provocative, like, you know, Matt Levine column about that, where he was like, what if we actually took this to its logical conclusion and companies could just determine on that for themselves the degree of insider trading that they were happy with. And some would be like, you can only, you know, none of our executives can ever sell stock until like a year after they've retired. And then some are like, everyone in the company has stock and is positively encouraged to trade in and out according to all of the information that they have and no one else has. And then just leave it up to the market whether, you know, which one of those two companies would trade at a discount because of those rules.
I mean, that's the system we have, though. That's not a crazy thought experiment. That's kind of how it works now. I mean, yes, in theory, you can be prosecuted for insider trading, but as the article shows, like, no one is. And, you know, when we do insider trading prosecutions, they're not prosecutions of stuff that's happening inside the head of an executive. Like, it's all like these quote-unquote, you know, tipper or tippy cases. The argument sort of against taking any of this seriously is just, this is how it is. There's no better solution. That was kind of like what Matt Levine argued. I feel like it's sort of what you're saying. And I think that I totally accept that. And then that's why, like, all these prosecutors, I don't think all these prosecutors who don't want to prosecute these crimes are corrupt or something. I think they're being intelligent, and they're looking at the law, and they're also looking at the degree of the crime, as you brought up. This is not as bad. Even if you think they're victims, the victims are much smaller scale than most other financial crimes. And they're drawing this conclusion. But I tend to agree with the, you know, this Wharton professor that there are ways that you could, you know, trim the regulation to make the markets work better. And I think one obvious thing are these trading plans. Like, it is crazy that you set a quote-unquote trading plan, and then you can just change your mind all the time. Like, I think executives at big corporations get paid a lot of money, and I think it would be better if their compensation were more transparent. And like, one way to make it more transparent would be to restrict their trading and a little bit more than it is right now. And then if you have to pay them a little bit more in cash or something then to make up for that, because otherwise they won't work there, I think that would be like a more honest and more transparent and probably like a more, yeah, I don't know, it just feels more equitable to me. And maybe you're right that maybe it would make no difference in practice.
Presumably it is entirely possible for any company listed on the U.S. stock market to unilaterally embrace such a rule, right? If I'm running, I don't know, Netflix, and I come out one day, I'm like, no executive is allowed to buy or sell any Netflix stock unless they have filed a plan with the general counsel at least 6 months in advance, and you can only, you know, you need to give 6 months notice if you want to change that plan, and, you know, like, put all of these rules in place, and if you trade in and out of Netflix stock outside those rules, we will fire you. And then, like, any company could implement that rule unilaterally without the government coming in and implementing that rule. Is it your opinion that if Netflix came out and did that tomorrow, that would be helpful for the share price, that shareholders would like be like, yeah, that's a great idea, we should rate Netflix more highly?
But I would care. I mean, but yeah,
you,
I think
you a reporter, you a Netflix watcher.
I mean, I think people would, you know, in the long run, like, it might build some brand equity. Like, if a company was seen as like a really responsible corporate citizen, and like, in the long run, like, I think that could conceivably, there's conceivable to help the share price. It also is conceivable that the next time an executive is called in front of Congress about something else, like, there will be more goodwill because it would be seen as a more ethical player. But no, I don't think Wall Street cares about that. I mean, they, you know,
Emily,
it's like,
has a very skeptical expression.
I just think if I'm a shareholder in Netflix and they announce that, my concern would be that it would hurt them in recruiting, because Netflix gets the best executives, say, are the best, they do the best hiring and whatever, because their stock is so valuable, blah, blah, blah. So maybe it could have this unintentional side effect where it hurts their ability to recruit and their stock goes down in that way because they lose talent. That was what I was thinking.
So you're selling then at that?
I mean, part of me is like, who is on the side of who cares? And beyond the who cares, I'm like, well, and then I think Matt Levine made these points, like, when you are an executive at a company, you always know stuff that no one else knows. You're always an insider. Any trade you do is insider trading because, duh, you know stuff. And, like, you're supposed to have a stake in how well the company does. Like, that's why you're ostensibly given stock, is because you have a stake in the company's success. So, of course, you're going to trade the stock and try and make money off the stock because you know stuff. You want the company to do well, and it all is like a virtuous circle, and it's all amazing. Just don't trade before some like really heinous thing happens. But even then, I'm like, well, it makes sense. You know, you're going to announce a heinous thing. You don't want to lose money. Okay, it's all fine.
Can one maybe be it's ethical all fine. Under capitalism? Is basically
I did not come into this podcast expecting Emily Peck to be more laissez-faire than Max Jafkin, but that seems to be where we wound up.
Hello, I'm Imi Harper. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, I tell the story of how a Hong Kong billionaire was silenced.
I got bombs thrown into my house. I got people came here, ransacked my computer. And I got people fractured me. I got this and that, but I'm safe.
And what it reveals about the freedoms Hong Kong no longer enjoys. Listen to Hong Kong's Rebel Billionaire on the Slow Newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
We need to talk about Carlos Watson. Stacey, who is Carlos Watson?
Carlos Watson was... I think
well, I love the fact that we're talking about him in the past tense already.
I mean, he's had a bad week.
He's had a very bad week. I think until the publication of a certain column by one Ben Smith of the New York Times this weekend, either a person who people may have encountered because he hosts various things, a person who most people outside of media had never heard of, or a person who has like tried to hire... most people in media at one point or another. And Carlos Watson, as of this week, is still the CEO of Aussie Media, which is part of a universe of, at the time, kind of the Upworthies, the Mikes. Some people like to put BuzzFeed in that category. Of the, you know, the digital media startups that would
Fusion?
Save the world. Fusion. Felix, please disclose your Fusion relationship in the spirit of transparency.
Well, yeah, I'll admit that I worked for Fusion if you admit that you worked for BuzzFeed.
I admit that I work for BuzzFeed all the time. And, you know, in the column that Ben wrote, he shared this mind-boggling anecdote that when Aussie was in fundraising conversations and they were having meetings with Goldman Sachs, one of their senior executives, a guy named Samir Rao, pretended to be a YouTube exec on the call with Goldman in an attempt to affirm that, you know, Aussie had this fantastic relationship with YouTube and that they had all of these incredible views. And it's unclear if the statements about their YouTube performance is actually true, but it is clear that Samir Rao was impersonating a YouTube executive on a call with Goldman Sachs.
Literally as we're recording this, like, more reporting is coming out from Axios about like massive pay cuts that weren't reported, people who were reported to have been investors who, like Sharon Osbourne was apparently an investor in Aussie, and now she's like, nope, I was never an investor. That guy's a complete shyster. The chairman has stepped down. The lead journalist, Cathy Kay, has stepped down. Axel Springer's, like, running away. Laureen Powell is running away. like, what is absolutely amazing, one of the things that's amazing to me is that one, so it was a blockbuster story. It was an amazing, like, jaw on the floor story from Ben Smith. But that one story about Samir Rao basically just, you know, committing blatant fraud is enough to completely implode a company. Like, this company does not seem to have any future anymore at all.
Well, because the story didn't just expose this one wild thing that Samir Rao did. It exposed this company as a total house of cards. They lied, according to Ben's piece. I don't know if he said they lied, but they claimed to have traffic that they surely did not have. No one is reading their content at all. Like, it was a mirage of a company. And the anecdote sort of, I think, confirmed a lot of what people in the media had probably been thinking for a long time. It's why you see all these news bits and scoops coming out. I've never seen anything so reported as this story about this company that really honestly doesn't matter. Like, everyone saw the ads for Ozzy, but no one ever saw an article from Ozzy. So as soon as Ben Smith's story comes out, you're like, oh, and it all clicks into place. Like, oh, this is not a real media company.
Yeah, there would be all of these YouTube videos with like 200,000 views and like 3 likes and 1 comment. And you're like, that's not how YouTube videos work.
At least 15 people should have said something hateful in the comments with those ratios. So,
and I guess a lot of media people probably feel like we've all lived through all the layoffs and all the shrinking and the downsizing and the pivoting to video and the pivoting away from video and the pivoting to TikTok
back to video,
and blah, 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 and the hiring and the firing and the na-na-na-na-na. And then you're the whole time that's happening with all those other companies you mentioned, BuzzFeed and Fusion and da-da-da, Ozzy's just somehow still going strong. And it's like, why?
Well, it's still going anyway.
It's still going and allegedly strong according to them, basically.
According to them. Although, yeah. Like, this is what one of the super interesting, like, subplots here is that Carlos Watson put out this statement basically saying Ben Smith is totally conflicted here. He should never have written this story because when he was at BuzzFeed, he tried to buy Ozzy and he was phoning me up and saying,
"Not Ben personally, more likely
no
Jonah.
Ben personally." Like, Ben personally was like phoning up Carlos and saying, "You should sell to BuzzFeed," or at least that's what Carlos is saying. Ben is not. Replied.
The disclosure in the Times piece supports that. He said he was involved in those discussions in the piece. Yeah.
But like, but the point being that like BuzzFeed did its diligence on Ozzy, that like Emerson Collective for one was encouraging Ozzy to sell, and you know Carlos Watson for whatever reasons decided not to. But like, there was at least, you know, there's some very smart people in media, i.e. Jonah Peretti, was like, yeah, this is a franchise that has real value and we should buy, and that was not that long ago.
I don't want to say anything about Jonah Peretti's smarts.
I will say that Jonah is coming out as an author on BuzzFeed. He put up a quiz this week about art and AI, which I can highly recommend everyone take. I got 19 out of 19.
Congratulations. I hope that book about BuzzFeed is actually just a history of all the women who built the place who get constantly written out of history. But that is a story for another show. One of the things that I have been fascinated by with Ozzy, and this is just kind of like meta media commentary, is the speed of the cycle with which this thing comes out on Sunday. And, you know, by we're recording on Friday, I think there's like 7 or 8 different deeply reported stories, including one from Bloomberg News, where they're like, we interviewed 18 different employees and this is what their working conditions were like. And you know, and everybody is really unhappy and has all of these incredibly compelling double and triple sourced anecdotes. And I'm always obsessed with this thing that happens in media, whether it's about a media company or another, which is like, you just need one crack. And everything that everybody was kind of vaguely aware of all the time just like really rolls into motion. And Emily, it's similar to what you said, right? Where Ben wrote it and then various of us in media were like, oh yeah, good point, and starts making calls. Yeah. So,
But it stands in stark contrast to like Theranos, right? Like that is exactly what didn't happen. Like you get this massive blockbuster story from John Carreyrou and then it takes a year to go as far as we've gone with Ozzy in a week. Probably longer than that.
Well, one, I think, is because media people leak like sieves. And when wanting to talk about the conditions of their workplace. So there is that. And two, and this was a point that I did see made and that I do agree in the abstract with, which is it's very easy to go after non-traditional executives, like both Watson and Samir Weil are not white men, or white women as the case may be, in a way that does not seem to apply in a lot of other cases.
Say more about that. I wondered about that too.
Yeah, I mean, one of the conversations that I've been having with folks is that there are, because there are relatively few black men leading media companies at either the executive level or the editorial, you know, sort of LA Times, Kevin Merida, editor-in-chief level, and that when any of the folks in these demographics, like, do anything wrong, there's this immediate reckoning of, like, see? Told you these folks shouldn't be in charge of media companies. And I remember, I'm going to use a girl boss. This is the only time I'm going to say girl boss on Slate Money, I promise. At sort of the height of the backlash to the girl bosses, when we had these stories about management problems at various, you know, e-commerce direct-to-consumer retailers, or you remember the Away fiasco about, you know, the Slack messages being like, why are you on holiday, et cetera, et cetera. There was a lot of commentary that, like, yeah, it's really easy to say that women CEOs behaving badly is a bigger story than male CEOs behaving badly. And I think within this commentary, there are always two tensions. One is that is societally true. And the other is when folks behave badly, we should hold them accountable. But it is easier for us to hold people accountable who are, you know, who don't look like we would expect them to.
I am so glad you said that, because reading Max's book, I had that thought about Peter Thiel versus Elizabeth Holmes, who rightly is on trial right now, right? And there's no question she's did wrong or whatever, but Peter Thiel and the PayPal mafia from almost the beginning did lots of like wild shenanigans that held up to scrutiny would also kind of fail a lot of tests. Like they let financial fraud just go on during PayPal so that more people would sign up for PayPal. And they knew it was happening and they did not stop it until they sort of like forced to, and they invented a whole new technology so they wouldn't really have to crack down in a serious way. And we have to thank these people for clicking on the traffic lights every time you want to sign up for something that is directly tied back. Anyway, but I was thinking a lot about that. What Peter Thiel is an evil genius, but Elizabeth Holmes is like a psychopath liar.
You read defenses of Thiel, and some of them have come out after the book has, you know, came out. I tried to be whatever fair, give credit where due, and be critical where due or whatever. But anyway, a lot of people have read it as too critical, and there are defenses that are like, yeah, he believes some crazy stuff, but look at these companies, these amazing companies, and it's kind of, I think that's a weird, really odd. It's like an odd defense. I mean, there is this, you know, PayPal Mafia is very male, very, very white network, right? And I mean, you know, there's been, I got into this a little bit in the book, but my colleague Emily Chang, you know, wrote about this in her book, Brotopia, but like a lot of the kind of Silicon Valley sexism, I think some of it dates to this network as well. And you, I mean, you can go back, and I don't want to drag everyone through this history, but you know, there's some stuff that the Stanford Review published a lot of, you know, stuff that, you know, I think really crossed the line on gender and sexual discrimination and things like that. And I think those values, you know, there's never really been any kind of accounting for any of that.
On which note, I think we should have a numbers round. Max, did you bring a number this week?
I have a number, yeah.
Do you want to hear
it? Number? Yeah, we want to hear it.
My number is 4.98 billion, which is the minimum amount of money that Peter Thiel would have to withdraw from his Roth IRA account, which is his tax-advantaged retirement account, should the legislation that's currently the Democratic legislation in the House to reform IRAs were to go through, because it would limit the amount of money you would have to keep in a Roth IRA to $20 million. Thiel has at least $5 million, and the law seems like entirely written for Peter Thiel. And that is really more to ProPublica's credit than mine. But in any case, it would really shake things up, and it wouldn't just shake things up for Peter Thiel. It would shake things up for a lot of Silicon Valley rich guys who have adopted this strategy as a tax mitigation.
I mean, I remember first coming across this strategy in the context of Mitt Romney running for president, that he had done something basically identical.
Okay, but crucially, Romney's IRA was not a Roth IRA. It was just a regular old IRA. So, like, he would still have to pay, and there was, like, some head-scratching at the time because, you know, it almost seems like he got that IRA by accident. Like, you know, just because, like, if you're in private equity, like,
and
you just
rich
bump
enough.
Into, you just start
just
bumping
tall,
into,
rich,
like,
white guy that just gives money. You things.
but I do think that IRA, and I talk about this in the book, like the Romney IRA thing was really bad for Peter Thiel because it created this entire like news cycle around IRAs, and Romney only had, I think, like $100 million in his IRA. And so like in Peter Thiel world, they're looking at that thinking like, ooh, like this seems like this could be a political problem for us. And of course it's maybe turning into one, although I think it's unlikely that there will be a real reform effort.
My number is $26,361. That is the average value of company shares held by women in 2018. And that compares with the average for men, which is $104,902. So a lot lower. And this really nice Wall Street Journal piece about the gender gap in stock options. So not only do women make less cash compensation, apparently they also get less stock too. So when all that insider trading is going on, women are at a disadvantage.
This is women like executives, I guess.
Women,
this is people
women
paid
executives.
In options and RSUs, and yes.
This was a look at stock options. Yes, sorry, employers, people who own their employer's stock.
I'm going to impinge on Stacey Marie territory with my number, which is $23 million, which is the amount of money that the Good Samaritan Ethereum miner gave back to the guy who accidentally paid $23 million in gas fees when he tried to transfer $100,000 in cash from one wallet to another wallet. This is one of the sort of standard, like, normal for a Tuesday crypto stories that, like, it's obviously why Stacey moved into this world, because these stories are amazing. But there's this, you know, stable coin, which is linked to the dollar, and you're like, I have $100,000, I want to move it from this wallet to that wallet so I can trade it somewhere else, fine. When you make those transfers, you have to pay a gas fee, which we do not need to go into. The gas fee on such a transfer is small, but if you want to, you know, make the transfer go quicker, it can be like quite expensive. It can be like $50 or $60 or something like that. But somehow, because of a software glitch, the gas fee on this transaction was $23 million. And this guy had $23 million in his account. So he just paid it and it went to this miner in an irrevocable, unreversible way. But then the miner, being like a good Samaritan crypto kind of person, who said, like, you know what, I don't really deserve this money, I'll give it back, and gave it back.
It's not the first of its kind.
That's like when you return the rental car and the, like, and then it, like, you, the only place to gas up is like $6.99 a gallon, and you're just like, oh darn,
gas fees, man. They're bad everywhere.
My order of magnitude different for sure, but yes. My number is $14.7 billion, and that is the size of the deal that Zoom and a company called Five9 didn't go through with. So Zoom, which we no longer have to explain, this being an episode recorded during a pandemic, was looking to acquire a company called Five9, which provides call centers, which is hashtag interesting synergy. But call center software provider, and Zoom's shares have not been doing great. And Zoom was like, oh, the value of this deal is no longer appealing to us. So we are going to withdraw.
I thought it was the other way around. I thought it was Five9 who pulled out because they reckoned that, partly Zoom's shares have been underperforming.
Zoom's shares
and
went
Zoom
down.
Was paying
Five9 was like, we're not interested. Exactly.
Yeah. But also because Five9 was like, look how much everyone else's stock has gone up since this deal was announced. Our stock would be much higher. It reminds me a little bit of when the Visa Plaid merger got unwound. You know, Visa announced they were buying Plaid for some gazillion, like $5 billion or something. And then they announced they weren't buying Plaid. And then Plaid was worth much more than that the minute the deal was unwound, because in the meantime, the markets had gone up so much that a company like Plaid was worth a fortune, or even more of a fortune.
Do you want to explain what Plaid is?
Next time. I feel like if I was explaining what Plaid is, that would take too long. And like, well, next time on Slate Money, I will explain.
We're gonna put that in the notes. I'm gonna remind you next week.
Next time we do a fintech show, we will talk about Plaid. But I think that's it for this show. Thank you for listening. Thank you very much to Max Chafkin for coming on. You're a superstar. And thank you for sending us the emails. We love them all on slatemoney@slate.com. Thank you to Shayna Roth for producing. And we will be back next week on Slate Money with even more.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.